Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The race is on, and the Belgian Grand Prix produced yet another victory for Lewis Hamilton, his fifth of the season out of seven races, to take his tally to an astonishing 89 Formula One victories. Once again, Valtteri Bottas couldn't match his teammate, but he was at least second ahead of Max Verstappen, as those three drivers filled the podium for the fifth time. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to review the Spa weekend are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. COVID-19 restrictions still in full force, Mark. You were our man on the ground at Spa this weekend. It looked like a very odd place to be for a Grand Prix without 100,000 fans dining on frites and mayo. Odd weekend?
Yeah, it was a little bit. The whole place was green, and it's usually orange, as you know. And it normally takes forever to get from one place to another, and it's really, really easy. So whilst much more convenient than normal, it was much sadder. You know, it was very, very sort of... if melancholy place, because you always associate it with such, you know, intense activity and the crowds getting involved and, you know, the wall-to-wall sort of Verstappen fans usually. So, yeah, just looking out across and the other side of the paddock and just seeing beautiful green valleys, it just didn't seem quite right.
Yeah, it was probably the only race where that sort of seemed to show up so far massively, shall we say. I know being at Silverstone, it felt quite empty, but yeah, it's just notable on TV. Yeah, strange. But Scott Mitchell, obviously you weren't in the right place for the race, but it does sound like you've had the right weather that we needed at Spa.
Yeah, it's been on off pretty rainy and stormy, especially this evening. But I think it sounds like the rain struck at Spa at the wrong time. Anyway,
it's been
quite heavy rain on off today. The sort that you're like, it doesn't need to be constant if it happens at a circuit, because there's enough rainfall in one of those 30-minute bursts to make sure that the track's going to be properly wet for a few hours.
Mark, you saying that it's raining now, how many times does this happen at race? This happened after the Spanish Grand Prix. It rained like an hour after the race or something. This constantly seems to happen.
Yeah, I know. And that threat of rain, it's because it was forecast, you know, from Friday through Saturday that, yeah, definitely going to rain on Sunday, we're going to have a wet race. That threat actually formed many of the choices that were made, which formed the race that we got rather than a race that we might have got. So, yeah, bit of a shame, really. I'll go into it in the race analysis, but that expectation of rain led Mercedes and Red Bull, or Red Bull in particular, to opt for a higher downforce, higher of the two rear wings that they had. And Mercedes felt secure in following suit. And had they not done that, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that had they both gone for their lowered downforce wings, i.e. had they been confident it wasn't going to rain, the Red Bull might actually have been a quicker car, because the Merc wasn't that great on its lower downforce wing. So, yeah, we might have had a bit of an upset, but as it was, we didn't quite. So there we are.
Yeah, that's a sad thing, because on Friday, it looked like there was kind of a hint of Red Bull being a little bit stronger relatively than usual. So it is a shame that we ended up with, what all three of the top three drivers admitted was a relatively boring race for them. You know, it's a one-stopper, straightforward. There was a little bit of intrigue, but no great action in that battle between Hamilton, Bottas and Verstappen, such as it was.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think we saw them tiptoeing through the last few laps as they're desperately trying to make that one stop. The tyres hang on. There were sort of little hints of the first Silverstone there. And I think that was certainly going through the minds of both those teams in the late stages. And just the time that they were tiptoeing, of course, we had Daniel Ricciardo doing his famous late charge, having looked after the tyres superbly, and in a Renault that was really on form this weekend. So, yeah, again, I think it could have been a different race. It could have been, I think we were just on the cusp of something much more interesting, but we didn't quite get over it.
It was a bit of there was a bit of British Grand Prix without the late race punches about this race, wasn't there? Just sort of, but I think probably with a little bit more, as Mark says, a bit more of a dynamic threatening to interfere with the race, but never quite getting there. Especially as Mercedes said, I think it was Andrew Shovelin said in post race that they've got some work to do for their low drag package for Monza, because they're worried that. The Red Bull looks pretty quick in a straight line if it goes for it, and they're not really sure they can go with them. So yeah, as Mark says, if they had been pushed into that properly low drag setup, that would have just been so much more fascinating than what we actually watched.
Yeah, it's frustrating when you have those weekends when it could have been. And actually, the point you make about Monza is a valid one, because Spa and Monza tend to get lumped together, but obviously Monza's the ultimate low downforce track. It doesn't have the sort of same long middle sector that we've got of corners at Spa. So, yeah, we can't assume it's going to be exactly the same same next weekend in Monza. But it's interesting, isn't it, Mark? Because, you know, we don't think any Grand Prix is boring. But when you hear the drivers, obviously in the press conference, they were saying, you know, I think Verstappen said he was basically managing for 38 of the 44 laps. So he only had a few laps where he was pressing on. And they all sort of agreed it was a little bit dull. And Lewis Hamilton said, look, don't blame us drivers. You know, it's the tyres, it's the difficulty of following, etc. That is a little bit of a shame when you come to this great circuit and you've got Lewis Hamilton, Max Verstappen, probably the two greatest drivers in Formula One right now, saying, yeah, it was a little bit dull even for us. And they're the ones in the car.
Yeah, and this is sort of a continuing of the... Lewis being very outspoken about the tyres. He started it at the end of the Spanish Grand Prix, and he spoke some more about it in the lead up to this one. And basically, they're just very frustrated with the tyres that they have, but at the same time, they're very, very aware of the constraints that have been put upon Pirelli. And Lewis in particular is very keen not to just rubbish Pirelli, because he's quite cognizant of the constraints that have led to this situation. But they have in the past, the drivers have always had these same concerns about these tyres, and they have in the past been very tight-lipped about it, and because partly for those reasons and partly because it wasn't something that Formula One wanted them to be talking about. But I think Lewis is in a position now where he just feels he can say what he thinks, and thankfully, he's deep thinking enough and articulate enough to get across the nuances of the situation. And I think now that he's spoken out, you'll probably see more doing so. And you heard Max today taking up Lewis's point and running with it. Valtteri was very brief, but he was totally supportive. He just sort of said, yeah, 100%, I agree, and that was it. But I think, yeah, we will see more. So there's a bit of, I think the drivers are taking the lead in putting this pressure on Pirelli and the FIA to come up with a better set of targets for Pirelli to meet, because it is quite it's quite a confusing demand that what they're after is a tyre that will still degrade, but it will degrade in a way that you're able to continue pushing on it. So you don't want it to heat degrade, basically. You don't want it to just get slow when you push too hard on it. And that's what we have at the moment. We've got a tire that tends to, once you get it past a certain temperature, be too slow. So you have to drive it below that limit, and that threshold, which is can be a couple of seconds off the pace. And essentially that's what they were having to do today to make a one-stop work. It's not a great way of racing, and it's something that needs to be tackled with a little bit more thought, I think.
Yeah, I was listening to the FIA's head of single-seater technical matters, Nicholas Tombassis. Hopefully I've done his job title justice there. I think that's correct. And he was saying that basically Pirelli was, in hindsight, given an impossible set of directives, basically, in the direction F1 and the FIA originally chose to go. You know, being asked to, you need to create a tyre that degrades quickly and produces loads of pit stops, but it also needs to be a tyre that drivers can push on and stuff like this. And now actually they're sort of looking and realising that the direction they've gone in is mistaken, because as I think Hamilton said after the race today, as soon as you know that losing track position is going to be a killer, you do absolutely everything you can to eke out that one stop, because why on earth would you want to sacrifice track position? And we saw that, I think, with Verstappen as well. He was, I think, 17 and a half seconds clear of Ricciardo in the Renault, but Red Bull weren't willing to take the risk of pitting him, even though he'd been on very fresh tyres, and presumably you'd think Ricciardo would be a sitting duck. But that combination of track position, the Renault's quick in a straight line, that Red Bull wouldn't take the risk over half a second or a second, because the threat of losing track position was so severe. So this is the state of modern F1, isn't it? And Hamilton is doing the right thing. And GPDA director Romain Grosjean said he was really pleased that Hamilton came out and is giving this constructive criticism and feedback, because the drivers need to keep the pressure on, because all this big, brave, brilliant, beautiful new era that's coming in 2022 is going to be ruined if the tyres aren't up to the task.
Well, this is the kind of unofficial position of the GPDA, is to put as much pressure as they can on in terms of the tyres, and what the target letter that specifies what Pirelli needs to produce from the tyres will be. And then, of course, there's two things. One, you want to get your target letter right. And two, Pirelli needs to be able to produce tyres that with the characteristics that are wanted. So it's a big challenge, but Mark, this has been going on for a while, hasn't it? So, the tyre sensitivity certainly needs to be got under control.
Yeah, it does, because it seeps through every aspect of the racing, as Scott was talking about there. And, you know, that example that he gave with Red Bull and Ricciardo, it cascades because Red Bull didn't want to bring Max in because of those concerns that they had about whether to get back past the Renault. That cascades because if Red Bull had done that, it would have put Mercedes under pressure. But because he didn't, it was stalemate. And so that we didn't get what could have been a fantastic, late, dramatic shuffling of the pack. So, it's... I think there is enough will and understanding now of the problem that it will be tackled, but it might not be an immediate thing. And I think the realistic target has got to be for 2022 when the new size of tyre comes in. But in Formula 2, that is a similar tyre being run already in Formula 2 for the first time this year. The drivers there are saying it's quite tricky. It's quite a tricky tyre. So I think there's still a lot of work needs to be done before we can safely say, yeah, I think we're going the right direction.
Yeah, and we should say it doesn't detract from what was a fine performance, certainly from Lewis Hamilton. So when really, really good qualifying lap, looked properly at one with the car, that was a really, strong one. Obviously, Bottas couldn't live with it. The race from Hamilton, obviously, everything was under control. He's a master tyre manager as well. He did have that brief off at the chicane, which was the one rare blemish. But yeah, just there was not really much more those drivers could have done to have made it exciting. Shall we move on to perhaps what was the surprise package to an extent of this weekend in Renault? Now, Scott, this was Renault's best weekend since it re-established its works team. That was in 2016, fourth and fifth for Ricciardo, and after that late pass on Alex Albon, Esteban Ocon. Ricciardo's fastest lap also earned them an extra point, which just edged this ahead of Monza last year, where Ricciardo and Hülkenberg were fourth and fifth in terms of being the best. So, firstly, this is a team that needed a result like this, isn't it?
Yes, it's a team that has bigger ambitions than it's currently producing in terms of what it's doing on track. And so far this season, it's sort of been it's sort of been okay and never really been special, with the exception of that. With the exception of that really, really good, was it the British Grand Prix, I think, the first Silverstone race, where they had a really nice and large points haul. Maybe it was the first or second Silverstone race, I can't quite remember now. But they've just, other than that, like you saw Barcelona, you know, which is always considered that great all-round test of a car. And the Renault was firmly further down the midfield order than it wanted to be in Spain. But they feel like they've unlocked something, or they've sort of found this weekend, because high downforce just is not their strength. They do seem to have made particularly good gains on traction this season. I think it's almost been a never-ending quest to improve the ride of the Renault, especially over the curbs, for the last 3 or 4 years, I think. And that just seems to be something that they've finally got a handle on. But basically what Ricciardo was saying after such a strong performance is, you know, maybe there's something in them exploring the low downforce stuff a little bit more, because the car does seem to respond really well to it. He was saying it's not just a case of they've come here with a low drag special and just taken all the wing off the car and flown in sectors 1 and 3 and dealt with it in sector 2. He said the car was good in sector 2. I look at his middle sector times in qualifying and they were really competitive when you consider how fast he was in sectors 1 and 3. So his argument is sort of, well, maybe this sort of low downforce actually brings out the best in this car. So rather than go to other tracks, and when you're looking at medium and high downforce settings and just be, you know, behind all the other teams in a straight fight, why don't we lean on this sort of low downforce spec? Because it seems to work for us, and maybe we can make it work elsewhere as well. So yeah, it's quite interesting. I think Renault, in my opinion, I think Renault are going to be that team in that fight for third, which is now, you know, an absolute it's a bit of a manic fight for third in the Constructors' Championship. But I feel like of all of the teams, Renault's the most likely that's going to be like anonymous one weekend and then have like a monster haul the next weekend, whereas it feels like McLaren and Racing Point in particular sort of tick over a little bit more consistently inside the top 10, and then Ferrari keep stealing the occasional big result because Charles Leclerc does a madness and actually puts in a heroic performance. But Renault just has these sort of peaks, and the good thing from their point of view, as you were saying, that they needed a result like this, they do at least hit it when that result is there. They've had two chances, I think, this season to get a big score, and they've got it both times, which is really encouraging.
I'm not sure though that sort of approach is going to net them third in the Constructors, though, because they'll go well at Monza, which is a low downforce circuit. They've gone well here because it's an aero compromise circuit, isn't it? You know, they were quick in the middle sector, but everybody's trying to compromise the sector 1 and 3 straight line speed with the twisty bits. You know, no matter how well you make a lower downforce approach work at an average circuit, shall we say, you're not going to get the performance out of it. So yeah, I'd worry for them a little bit. What it does show is that they've got to make absolutely sure, as you say, Scott, that they nail these weekends when they have a track characteristic advantage, shall we say. So they need to do more of the same at Monza, but very, very positive for them, you have to say. But they need to understand what it is when they're piling on the downforce that isn't working for them, whether they've not got good control over the whole aero map of the car, etc. But one thing we should say, Daniel Ricciardo's driving really well this year for the most part, isn't he, Mark? You know, that was a really, really strong drive. I can't really see he could have done anything more, especially as he had a brake-by-wire problem that was causing some problems in qualifying as well.
Yeah, he was fantastic all weekend. I mean, he's just a mega driver, I think. Someone that should always have been in a top car. I don't see why he couldn't go head-to-head with anyone, really. Hamilton, Verstappen, Alonso, I think he's of that caliber. And he threw the dice a couple of years ago, and we've only seen him sort of under the radar. But he's done several brilliant performances when you look at the caliber of the machinery that he's had. And it's been too often for it to be just sort of roll of the dice that he's had a good weekend. It's his qualities and his understanding and his talent that's bringing those level of performances. And then when you you put him in a car that's working around the track. There he is. He pops straight back up again. And, you know, he's got a quality teammate there, Esteban Ocon. Very, very quick driver. You know, really made an impact when he first came into F1. Pretty much instantly as quick as Sergio Perez and Force India. Quicker than him by the end of his second season. And yeah, okay, he's had a year out and probably got a bit rusty. But we're well into the season now. And Esteban's getting within a couple of tenths, you know, which is good. But I do think that's I don't see that particularly as there must be something wrong with Esteban's car. I think this is just Daniel's level has been underrated. And I think this is just where he's at.
Yeah, I think Ricciardo's brilliance needs to be sort of reappraised a little bit, because in his farewell Red Bull season, he obviously had lots of different problems, didn't he? And Verstappen was starting to build a bit of momentum for himself. And I think it knocked Ricciardo's stock, not necessarily amongst people sort of that know him particularly well or a bit more in the know, but I think just the external perception did drop a little bit. And it then took a little bit of time for him to establish himself at Renault. So I think we're now starting to see why Ricciardo's so special. And I don't know about the two of you, but he to me is the most painful driver to watch get stuck in the midfield in a situation like he did in the Spanish Grand Prix, for example. Because like someone like Ocon, the McLaren drivers, Leclerc at Ferrari, you do feel like, well, they've got a long future ahead of them. They've got time on their side. And with Ricciardo, I just feel like I'm watching a driver who is worthy of a world championship challenging car be sniping for the odd result. And while it's great to see him produce a performance like he did this weekend, it does make a little part of me pang for a time where he can actually do this on a more regular basis.
I think it would be a crime if he got to the end of his career and he'd never been in a car that gave him a shot at the world championship to at least have just one crack at it. And there's a risk he may end up never in that position, which would be a shame. But yeah, basically ever since the second half of last season, he's been performing really, really well, particularly on race day, when he's just superb. And I hope we'll see him back on the podium fairly shortly. That'd be good for him and Renault. Mark, before we look at the rest of the points finishers, should we cast our eyes down to 13th and 14th place? Sebastian Vettel, Charles Leclerc. We knew this was going to be a bad weekend for Ferrari, but it almost managed to fall short of those low expectations. They both finished behind the customer Ferrari engine Alfa Romeo of Kimi Raikkonen. I mean, come on, explain.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you look at I did a little piece in our Ferrari reaction piece on therace.com, and when you look at how far off pole they were, they were about normal, closer to pole than they were in Spain or Hungary or the first Silverstone. But because this is a track where any downforce deficit doesn't get punished very much, and any lower drag that's associated with a lower downforce is more highly rewarded than at conventional tracks, there's a much smaller gap between the front and the back. So it has the effect of moving everybody around Ferrari up because Ferrari have got the worst of both worlds. They've got a high drag car with a low power engine, which is exactly what will hurt you around here. So they fell spectacularly down the order. And there's no way that an Alfa Romeo or a Haas is as good a car as the Ferrari on a conventional track, where your cornering speeds are pretty much determining your lap time. But here, a car that's a bit short of downforce also gets a nice little present of being down on the what's very costly around here, which is drag. And yeah, I think the Alfa, I think we were just talking about it before, Ed, where you were saying that had Kimi got all these best sectors together, Kimi would probably have out-qualified the Ferrari. And then so we saw that natural order sort of reasserting itself in the race. And the Alfa just looked a better package around here than the Ferrari. It's simple as that. But on a conventional track, no, it would be well over half a second off again. But it, if you, once we saw the actual true picture at the first race and where the Ferrari, how the Ferrari compared both to last year's car and to its rivals this year, and you could have all mapped out all the circuits and done a software program, it, I think it would pretty much have predicted this sort of weekend for Ferrari at Spa and Monza. So it'll come as a bit of a shock to everyone, but I think actually it was foreseeable.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you mentioned Raikkonen there. Now, even Giovinazzi could have nipped into Q2 and bumped Leclerc, and the Haas drivers were massively compromised because Friday was ruined for both of them pretty much by engine problems. And, you know, that would have been particularly embarrassing. Roman Grosjean was right behind the two Ferraris. Well, yeah, just a really difficult situation for them. But, you know, it just underlines what we've been saying all season, really, that it's absolutely critical they take a big step with the engine into next season. You know, a really big step, because obviously then they're going to be butting up against development restrictions, etc. Obviously, you can't just keep developing your engine. There's now windows for upgrades, and they're going to be in serious trouble if they don't make a step forward next year. And Monza's going to be even, you know, another bad one for them, isn't it? They're going to struggle there. Slightly more straightforward circuit, should we say, in terms of not having the same compromises as Spa. But, you know, they're not going to be nicking a podium there, are they?
No, I would imagine they're going to be in pretty much the same part of the grid, and slightly better or slightly worse, depending on whether they get the tyres working or not. And because that was a cascading problem around here, was the whatever downforce level they chose, it then got more complicated by the fact that when you went too low, the tyres stopped working. So they were really, really in a tiny, tiny little window in which it was making any sense at all.
They're certainly going to enjoy having Monza and then going to Mugello for their celebration 1,000th Grand Prix. They're marking at Mugello, although you can dispute the exact number that it should be. So yeah, it's just a horrible season for Ferrari, and just fractious and difficult, and it's clearly very very tough for them there. Shall we go back to the business end of the at least closer to the business end of the grid, Scott? McLaren, as you mentioned earlier, I think they're pretty consistent in that group. Obviously, Carlos Sainz couldn't make the race start. He had a power unit problem that caused some kind of exhaust failure and a fire. Lando Norris went from 10th on the grid and finished 7th, and he actually felt he would have passed Albon, who we haven't really spoken about much in the other Red Bull, for 6th place had he been given one more lap. And the McLaren is that all-rounder in that midfield group, isn't it? Which actually I think is quite positive for them, that they've got a kind of good average, should we say, car, and they can just sort of keep picking up these points. And considering they only had half the number of points opportunities they should have done in this race, I think it's a good weekend for them to have gained a bit of ground on Ferrari and Racing Point.
Yeah, I think they made the best of a not bad situation, but they got the maximum out of the day, which is all you can ask for. They didn't expect to be as competitive as some of their immediate rivals, just because I don't think they had the extent of what Renault had in terms of a low drag setup here. So I think McLaren did quite a good job. Lando drove quite well, especially as he fell back initially and was sort of looking like he might even struggle to get inside the top 10. But, you know, as others moved towards the two-stop strategy, as Ferrari's or Leclerc's challenge faded after a great one lap, a great first lap rather, then Norris and McLaren just did what they quite like doing, go about their business. And they obviously had the big standout results, didn't they, in the first two rounds of the season. But one of the things that I think has been quite important this year that's been overlooked is that, you know, Carlos Sainz is probably the unluckiest driver in Formula One at the moment. He has had a season that does not look on paper as good as it has actually been. He doesn't have the points to show for the season he's actually put together. And that carried on again today with the non-start. And if that happened, if you had all of these like stealthily put together sixth and seventh places that have maybe been lost, then the points haul would be even more impressive. So this isn't a team that, when we say is consistent, is just constantly sniping for eighth or ninth. Is it whether they've got the third fastest car, fourth fastest car, fifth fastest car, or sixth fastest car, they just always seem to put something together to be in top seven, top eight contention. And I think that's just the mark of a very good race team with a pretty good car. It's not special. And maybe it lacks the ultimate peak performance to have the flashes like we've seen from Renault today, but it's damn reliable. And I still think McLaren's got a really good chance of that. They would be, I think they're still my pick for third in the Constructors' Championship, just because I think a few of the other teams are a bit too flaky.
Well, they've got the position at the moment, which is very encouraging for them. And yeah, like you say, just that the performance is usually there to a decent level. They don't have these fluctuations. And yeah, two good drivers. Yeah, Sainz has lost, you know, 30-plus points this year. Think back to that that late tyre failure at Silverstone, for example. That cost him a big result. How about Albon, Scott? Obviously, you've been keeping a close eye on him. You ran an interview with him on the race website in the build-up to the race weekend. He finished sixth, qualified not quite as close to Verstappen as he looked like he was going to. Didn't quite have the perfect last Q3 run. At one point in the race, they were hoping that he could kind of manage the tyre a little bit on the mediums and then maybe attack Ricciardo later on. Obviously, that came nowhere near happening and he got passed by Ocon right at the end. So it's another one of those mixed bag weekends for Albon, isn't it?
Yeah, he still hasn't been able to put together a full weekend. Slightly similar to Spain, just without the massive consequences. He lost out at the start. I think he paid the price with losing track position, especially to the Renaults, which are fast in a straight line. Couldn't force his way through. And then he spent a bit of time stuck behind the long-running AlphaTauri of Pierre Gasly, whose seat he took 1 year ago at Spa. And just sort of laboured, really, until the final sort of third of the Grand Prix, final quarter of the Grand Prix, maybe, during which Red Bull, I think both cars were into management mode with the tyres, and Albon's pace matched that of Verstappen. But what's the point of being as quick as Max for 9 or 10 laps of damage limitation at the end of the Grand Prix when you've already put yourself 20 seconds, half a minute behind and vulnerable? Because ultimately, both Red Bulls had the same problem today. The difference was Max was so much better that he put his car in a bit of track position where he wasn't vulnerable to the cars behind, whereas Albon was in the thick of it and therefore was on the defensive, which presumably made his situation even harder.
Mark, where do you stand on Albon at the moment? We had a good chat on last week's podcast as well about Albon and his position. What would you be doing with him if you're a Red Bull, and what do you think is just the missing element for him?
I think doing what they're doing, which is reiterating that they have every faith in him. And I don't think on this occasion this is like the football manager, the football club talking about the football manager, and a week later he's sacked. I do think that they really, really want this to work, and I do think that to have a good, reliable backup to Verstappen is what they want. They're not looking for someone who can beat Verstappen, who can outdrive Verstappen. It's fine. They know they've got arguably the fastest, certainly equal fastest driver in the world. So they're not looking for someone that can outperform that level. They're looking for someone who can adequately back him up. And Albon's actually not that far away from doing that, but he does have a breakthrough still to be made. And this weekend was, I thought, much, much better than Barcelona. I thought his Barcelona weekend was terrible. It snowballed a bit. It wasn't, you know, as we talked about at the time, that Barcelona weekend wasn't entirely his fault. But I thought there was overall it was a poor showing. But here this weekend, I thought it was okay. He was closer through. He did a long run on Friday afternoon. That was very good indeed. And if he can just get like another row up on the grid, he can put that sort of pace and rhythm into the race, he'd be looking in pretty good shape. As it was, yeah, the tyres, he got ahead of Ocon at the first pit stop because they turned him around quicker. But then his tyres faded because he was trying to attack the Renault of Ricciardo for a big chunk of the race, and he didn't have the straight line speed to be able to do it. So effectively he was attacking it and destroying his tyres for no upside. He didn't ever get the place because the Renault was just too fast at the end of the straight at the only passing place. So, yeah, that just meant his tyres were destroyed, and eventually, late in the race, Ocon managed to repass him. So, yeah, not great, but I think if you put the pieces together, they are there. It's not that they're missing. It's just they're not being put together.
Yeah, it's just that feeling that there just needs this one weekend where it kind of clicks and he gets to that sort of good quality support level, shall we say, to Verstappen. But, you know, the raw material is definitely there. Now, let's, Mark, have a look behind Norris. Norris was seventh. So behind him, we have Pierre Gasly in eighth, Lance Stroll ninth, and Sergio Perez 10th. Gasly and Perez are interesting because they didn't stop under the safety car, which was kind of the default strategy. Made sense for Gasly because he'd started on hard. He'd had a really good first stint as well. But it did seem extremely odd for Perez, seeing as he was on softs and he was into the pits not that long after the restart. In the end, it didn't make a great deal of difference, I think, to Perez's result, because he was kind of in Force India race pace territory just behind Stroll. But what did you make of the strategic approach of those two? Because they did produce a little bit of variety and some overtaking.
Yeah, I could understand it with Gasly. The safety car came at exactly the wrong time for him because he started on the hard. So to be stopping 11 laps into the race just didn't make sense. So, yeah, I could see what they were trying to do. They were trying to do to go long and establish a bit of field spread and then come in and get on the quicker tyres and have a big tyre offset for the second stint when he would be quick. And it sort of worked. It wasn't the ideal timing for the safety car, but given that they got that bad break, I thought they did well, and I thought Gasly was driving superbly. He was setting some great times on the hard tire and actually racing people that were on the medium tire and doing quick times. And even after the restart, when everybody got to change onto mainly onto the medium or the hard, he was still quick, and despite being on all tyres. So I thought he was doing a great job. He did some fantastic moves. The one on Sergio Perez into a Rouge was, it's terrifying actually, but it was incredibly brave. And yeah, I think he's doing a great job. And I think the strategy call, yeah, it made sense. The one for Perez, no, I really couldn't get that, other than if he just stayed where he was and did the same as everybody else, he wasn't going to get anywhere because they weren't in particularly quick here, and they weren't quick at the end of the straight, so they weren't going to progress. So maybe they were just thinking, let's throw the dice and see what we can do, but it didn't really work. He made a bit of a recovery, but it was only back to about where he would have been anyway.
Yeah, I think that was about racing point territory. Obviously, the big change in car concept means that traditional spa strength for that team wasn't really there. I think myriad little things in qualifying held them back a bit, and then they just were where they were. But yeah, Gasly performing really well. If you look at the moment, he's going past Perez when Perez squeezes him on the run to Eau Rouge up against the old pit wall, because that's obviously
the support race pit wall.
Exactly, yeah, the other pits. It's really, really tight there. So you can understand why Gasly was a little bit irritated by it. But he said as soon as he started to be squeezed, he thought, well, I'm not going to back off in this. So, yeah, he made the move. And Kvyat, you know, he didn't have a... again, it's frustrating. He out-qualified Gasly for the first time, but Gasly would have beaten him, but got a little bit too aggressive on the throttle out of the last chicane on his lap in Q2. And then, yeah, Kvyat seemed to just struggle a little bit with the tyres in the race, which was a little bit odd. He was on the normal strategy. Ended up 11th, but it wasn't he wasn't kind of right up against the queue of cars in front. And obviously he was passed by Perez and Gasly, who had the tyre advantage. So yeah, a tricky race for Kvyat. Let's talk about the crash, shall we, that did define the race strategy, Scott. Antonio Giovinazzi lost the rear end at the exit of the Fania right-left. Odd place to go off. That was on the 10th lap. It's never good to see a loose wheel getting collected by another car, which is what happened to Russell after, obviously, Giovinazzi tried to correct, but just sort of fired the car the other way into the barrier. But that loose wheel it could have been a worse situation, couldn't it, for those two?
Yeah, we were talking when it happened about how it's one of those that look worse than the aftermath makes it look worse, because you think when you see the initial shot, it looks like it's a case of a car being ploughed into, and fortunately that wasn't the case. But as soon as I saw the replay from Russell's onboard, because it was just so confusing what happened until you actually saw Russell's onboard, and you saw that the wheel that had become detached from the Alpha and ripped off bounced across and hit Russell's front right wheel, broke it and sent him into the barriers. Like, any time you just see a wheel like that, an errant wheel, that it's just scary because you don't know where it's going to go. On this occasion, it broke the wheel and then didn't go near the driver. The halo exists to hopefully protect George if it did. But even then, you don't know where the wheel's gone after that. I don't know where Marshalls might be situated. It's obviously an unusual part of the circuit. I don't know if there are any particularly on that side of the barrier or anything like that. But you just don't know. So it's just frightening. And it's a reminder of why devices like the halo are important, because it wasn't called on this occasion. But it didn't really need a lot changing about those circumstances for the halo to have been called into action, did it? If Russell had been a tenth or two tenths closer to the Alphas at any point on that lap, if Giovinazzi had gone into the wall a couple of miles an hour slower, if Russell had changed the direction of his steering wheel, if he opted for a different route, like, there's loads of things that could have impacted how that incident unfolded. So fortunately, looked a lot worse than it was. I think, as most people said afterwards, the main thing was that both of them walked away and were okay from it, because it was quite a frightening impact.
Yeah, it was certainly a much better accident, should we say, than it initially looked from that initial shot, because I, for some reason, was on board with Giovinazzi at the time that happened, but you get the onboard slightly after. So I was sort of watching it, and effectively this is a replay, because I knew there was some kind of accident. But as he was bouncing back off the wall, I was sort of thinking, oh, there's going to be an impact here. And I was quite surprised there wasn't, fortunately, because he didn't get collected. So that at least was positive. But yeah, Giovinazzi, you know, that's a mistake he didn't need as well, because there's question marks over his F1 future. That's the second Belgian Grand Prix in a row he's crashed out of. He was trying to hang on to Vettel. So, unfortunate for him as well. And Russell, again, had done really well in qualifying, fifth time in Q2. It's a little bit frustrating, I think, for Williams, because he keeps getting into Q2, but they've run out of their top engine mode by the time they get there. So he's never able to kind of crack on, and he might have been able to pick off a Ferrari or two had he had that available to him. But then lost a few places on the first lap. He actually got briefly ahead of Vettel and then went off on the first lap and slipped behind the Alfa Romeos and Magnussen. And Haas, yeah, Grosjean finished 15th, Magnussen 17th. Magnussen was having all sorts of tyre troubles that they didn't entirely understand. He ended up two-stopping, finished behind Latifi, also two-stopped. But Latifi was complaining about this kind of asymmetric handling imbalance, he called it, where it was oversteering in one direction and understeering in the other direction. Williams struggling a little bit at times, and Russell was talking about the fact that they've had the car being very tricky early in races and being at times in races this year undrivable really early on. So something for Williams to work on there. I think we've covered all the drivers pretty much there. I guess we should just pick up as well on Kimi Raikkonen, who finished 12th. Pretty good, considering he was last into La Source after the anti-stall kicked in at the start. He didn't quite get the launch procedure right, but a solid Class C, as we call it, victory there with the Ferraris guesting in that little battle at the back as well, which was good fun. We've got to have a little bit of a look off track as well, Mark. And as ever, the Racing Point Brake Duct Saga produces an episode pretty much every week, doesn't it? And on Tuesday, in the build-up to the race, Renault withdrew that appeal against the stewards' verdict, but the Ferrari appeal against that is still live. It's about more than brake duct design, though, isn't it? This is a wider political picture.
Yeah, it's about not only the whole concept of what is a customer car and what isn't, it's and what it's construct and what isn't. It's also about a little bit of horse trading for Ferrari and what it wants for next year, because The constructor issue has probably been resolved now with the FIA saying it's going to put out a much more strict definition. So that has more or less been answered, and that's probably why Renault felt relaxed about dropping their appeal. But Ferrari is very unhappy about the fact that, as things stand, if you are one of the teams such as Racing Point or AlphaTauri that can upgrade from a 2019 parts to 2020 parts, so they're specifically talking about rear suspension in the case of the Racing Point, that doesn't count as one of your three development tokens. And so Ferrari is very nervous of that because the Racing Point is already pretty quick, and they're thinking if it gets the rear suspension of the Mercedes W11, which is believed to be one of the key reasons why the W11 is so much quicker, then that's another car that, you know, that is going to be very, very difficult for them to beat. So they feel it unfair that doesn't count even as a development token. So because the Concorde agreement is now live and the governance is slightly different, it is possible now, if there's enough agreement between the teams, to reverse that. And then that's what they're campaigning for. I think they would probably drop the brake duct appeal if they could get what they wanted on the token issue.
Yeah, as always, it's about the horse trading, should we say, in the background. But yeah, as it stands, that appeal is still very much so. It's been a really fractious one, hasn't it, Scott? This whole thing, because there's so many kind of tangents to the, what is effectively a case about the design of the rear brake ducts and the front brake ducts of one specific car. It's pretty amazing. It's so far-reaching. What do you think is going to happen? It seems likely that there's going to be an accord reached before the ICA hears this appeal, surely, isn't there?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go that far. I think you can see they've been picking them off one by one, depending, I guess, on what the low-hanging fruit is. You know, the likes of Williams and McLaren were pretty easy to knock back because they ostensibly were going after the clarification that the FIA had already promised. So they fell off pretty quickly. I was surprised that Renault backed off so fast, but Mark's explained why. So now it's just Ferrari versus Racing Point are the ones left standing. So I get why Ferrari almost have to do it's not posturing as such, but they just have to do everything by the book now, don't they? So if they're going after them because their argument is, oh, it's too lenient a punishment, then they have to challenge the reprimand. So I understand that. It's all just brinkmanship, political games, a bit of chicken involved. Who's going to blink first? So it's just a good old-fashioned off-track F1 rumbling, isn't it? And at some point, everyone will get a bit of what they want and put up with a bit of what they don't want. And then it'll all be brushed aside, and then we can all get ready for whatever the next big controversy is that gets not necessarily blown out of proportion, because I think this is a very serious issue. But as you say, this is all this issue is all about the specific legal or illegal development of brake ducts, but it's simultaneously about nothing to do with the brake ducts and about much bigger issues involving everybody. So yeah, very complex and a very, very Formula One argument.
Yeah, I imagine there'll be a few more episodes before it's finally case closed. But yeah, hopefully it'll calm down eventually and we can stop talking about brake ducts. Well, to finish off, let's just circle back round to the front. Another moment of sympathy for poor old Valtteri Bottas. That's the sixth race in a row he's lost ground to Hamilton in the championship. I think that's 50 points he's lost to Hamilton in the past six races. What's it, 47 points now? So it's almost... it's almost two race wins worth. We were asking whether Bottas at the start of the season could sort of hang on in there and make a fight at the championship, but now it's looking like he's on target for Hamilton to kind of eliminate Bottas from the championship with at least two races to go this season. Hard work, isn't it, Mark, for a driver like Bottas? He's doing a good job, but just can't do what Hamilton does on a consistent basis. And no matter how good he gets, and he was saying that this is his strongest year in terms of race performances, there's always this all-time great just most of the time doing better.
Yeah, that's just what it like. It's just what it's like if you're alongside one of the greats, isn't it? And you do feel sorry for him because, you know, if he was in a Renault, say, or something like that, it would be, you know, not so. You know, he'd look better than he'd be perceived, probably better than he's being perceived. But he doesn't see it like that. This is where he wants to be, and he's just got to keep trying. And as he said after the race, he said, "I'm trying everything." And he said, "There's still 10 races to go, and I can't just give up. I'd rather than accept that Lewis was going to win this championship, I'd rather just stay at home." So I'm not going to do that. So that's all he can do. He is a competitor, and he is like very, very hard on himself, and he is always looking to improve, and he is capable of some great performances. But it's just he's not Lewis Hamilton, and that's just how it is.
Yeah, and he was a little bit disappointed that he couldn't attack Hamilton at the start because things didn't quite work. But Scott, there was obviously this message that people were interested in where Bottas was told that you don't use the kind of overtake mode against each other. I think Toto Wolff talked about that after the race, didn't he? Did he clarify that when you heard from him?
Yeah, he basically said that they would only have a limited number of uses of it, basically. And because of the proximity of Verstappen and qualifying and the speed that the Renaults were showing, they didn't want to basically burn up what they'd allocated basically as allowed number of uses on a needless fight between the two of them at the front, because ultimately Mercedes doesn't care whether Lewis wins or Valtteri wins. What they care about is that one of the Mercedes comes home first and ideally the other Mercedes comes home in second. So they don't care about the order. So when you've got the threat from behind, that was their focus. And basically what Toto said is there appears to have been a miscommunication of some kind. So either Valtteri wasn't given that information, or Valtteri wasn't given that, like, given the information as clearly as he needed to be given it, or he misunderstood or something. But it was something that was agreed. It was just something that Valtteri, however it was relayed to Valtteri, he wasn't quite convinced what it meant.
So I don't think it would have made any difference. I think Bottas could have thrown everything he could have possibly laid his hands on at Hamilton and still wouldn't have been able to beat him. Just before we finish, quickly look ahead to Monza, Mark. We've got this engine mode rule change following a technical directive being issued. Some dispute about whether it'll make much difference to the competitive order, and Mercedes saying, well, it's aimed at us, but we think we'll still be okay. Are you expecting to see anything particularly different from that? It's certainly going to be interesting because it's going to require all the engine manufacturers to make some fairly significant changes to the way they run the engines, the way they choose the maps and the settings, etc. So it's a fair bit of work to adapt to, which is why it was put back a race in the first place.
Yeah, globally, I don't think if you look at it in hindsight, when we get to the end of the season, you look back, you see, okay, pre-Monza and post-Monza, what was the picture, and did it alter the competitive picture, Mercedes versus the rest? No, I don't think it's going to make any difference. I think the Mercedes' advantage is such that even if you trim a little bit of qualifying power from it, which is what it will do, they're still going to be quick enough to be sitting on pole and probably locking out front rows. And that extra engine life just gets redeployed in the race. So now I don't see there's a net gain really for the competition, but having said that, I think we might see something slightly different in Monza if the Mercedes is not working very well in this super low downforce trim. It could just be that it coincides with the mapping change to give the appearance of, look, there's the difference. But we've already seen hints that in this super, super low downforce that they didn't run here. They tried, but they didn't run it. But they probably will have to run it at Monza because of the nature of the circuit. It might just not be very good, that aero package. And if that aero package isn't very good, there's a chance it might just get pipped to pole, or, you know, Max might get among them and split them even. in which case everybody will say, there you go, you see, it was the engine boats. But I think we've got to be look over more than just once, one race as a sample. But let's see.
Yeah, well, that's just one of the many reasons to follow the Italian Grand Prix next weekend. We, of course, will be there. Mark is heading on towards Monza fairly shortly. Do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. Loads to read there. Mark's race analysis. My driver ratings will be up, and Scott Mitchell's delving into all sorts of things Ferrari related and other to talk about. Check out our YouTube channel. Just search for The Race. Loads of videos on there, and subscribe to some of our other podcasts. Bring Back V10s, the Gary Anderson F1 show, and of course the Race F1 podcast if you're not already subscribed. We'll be back next week with everything you need to know from Monza.